From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 28th day of April, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Matt Blaisdell of the Andersons Climbers Facility in Delphi, Indiana. In today's agricultural news, within a week of saying the administration would let others write the farm bill, the Secretary of Agriculture is calling for a discussion that would completely overhaul the legislation's agricultural safety net. The leading Republican on the House Agriculture Committee is already fired back. And the majority leader in the Senate is prioritizing legislation. Harry Reid thinks the body should consider climate change before it takes up immigration reform. Dave Dickey will be along in a moment with these and many more ag news stories. And in the second half hour of our program today, on some of these radio stations and always online at willag.org, we'll talk with Phil Tsang of the U.S. Meat Export Federation. He's some pretty interesting stories about agricultural trade over the last three decades. And don't forget, in just 26 minutes, we'll talk with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City about the agricultural weather forecast right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production, of course, of Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Hear the way the numbers settled in Chicago on this Wednesday afternoon. Futures from the wheat pit at $4.76 and a quarter, down to July at $4.88, 2.5 lower. And September at 504 and a quarter, down 2.75. July in hard red country over in Kansas City at 502, a penny lower. But then things turned green in the corn pit from Chicago. Nearby May futures, 357, up 9.5 cents. July at 364, 10.25 higher. September at 371, up 9.5. And December futures, 377 and 3/4, up 8.75. March contract, 390.5, up 8.5 cents. May soybean futures, 982 and 3/4, unchanged. July at 993.5, up a half. The August at 991 and a quarter, a penny and a half higher. September soybeans at 976, 3.25 higher. And November futures at 965.5, 3.75 higher. May bean meal, 288.60, up $1.60. July at 289.40, up 2.60. May bean oil at 38.54, down 58. July at 38.92, down 64. April live cattle unchanged at $98 and a nickel. June at 93.42 and a half, down 30. April feeders at 113.27 and a half, up 7.5. The Mays were down 77.5 at 112.30. And the main lean hogs at 88.20, 7.5 cents higher on this Wednesday. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's how the outside market settled on the day. June futures, $83.19, still trading actually in the crude oil, up 75 cents. May ethanol at $1.59, a penny and 8 cents higher. Natural gas at $4.27 and a tenth, up 5.5 cents. Heating oil or diesel fuel down 3 tenths at $2.22 and 7 tenths. And the gold at $1,171.30, up $9.60. The Dow Jones Industrial Average just about 64 points higher at 11,055. And the U.S. dollar at 82.37, up 0.23 on the day. The CRB index at 274.51 is 1.33 higher for the afternoon. And the Goldman Sachs at 538.74, up 1.83 on the day. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like. It's prepared by our own Ed Kieser. He says much above temperatures will replace the frosty conditions that were found across Illinois and Indiana this morning. The warmer temperatures will ride in on the back of a powerful southerly flow that will also bring an increase in moisture and the potential for flooding rains to the area. Rainfall will return in the form of showers and thunderstorms. That'll happen on Friday and early Saturday. The heaviest rain will target far southern Illinois and the southern half of Indiana. Some locations along the Ohio River could exceed 4 inches by Monday morning. A follow-up weather system will bring the next chance for rain into the western part of Illinois on Tuesday and then spread across the two-state area through Wednesday of next week. Soil temps will have dropped below 50 degrees in northern halves of Illinois and Indiana, although they'll rebound by the end of the work week as morning low temperatures should return to the 50s and the 60s. Wind gusts out of the south will exceed 30 miles an hour in many areas on Thursday, and the winds will remain brisk on Friday before diminishing on Saturday afternoon. More on the ag weather when we get to the bottom of the hour.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. We're joined by Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, to take a look at the agricultural futures markets. Good afternoon to you, Paul.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, did farmers sit back and watch the corn grow yesterday and then were happy today as prices went up?
Well, of course, the amount of corn planted is just unbelievable for this time of year. And after the first big inch of rain, we did see a lot of cash movement in corn. That's very typical. As a former grain merchandiser, that happened 30 years ago when we were buying and selling corn and soybeans in the marketplace. Historically, the first big grain after sitting on a planter for a week, you move grain. Couple of reasons why they moved it, of course, need cash flow. They still have a ton of corn. And the third thing is that if you have grain stored at a country elevator, you have end of the month storage and more storage payments due. The marketplace is seeing a lot of jitters. You know, one day it's up 10 cents, the next day it's down 10 cents. And historically, that tremendous oscillation does scare the typical commodity trader. But the good news is we did see two cargoes of corn sold to China, sold out of the West Coast, probably to a Chinese feed mill. There are restrictions on vomitoxin. It's a small parcel of corn, but, it's a start. They do have a big inventory in China. The price of corn in their internal market's high. They've had weekly auctions. So it wasn't a total surprise. They've been buying some corn from Thailand.
You've had some time now to talk to producers as they've been off of the planters. Did they put more corn in the ground than they expected?
I think there's no doubt in my mind they did in Illinois.
And are they going to continue to do so when they get a chance to get back in?
Well, when you're done, there's only so much corn you can plant. it was a function of we were going. The corn bean price didn't have a thing to do with it. It was early, and of course, Southern Illinois was getting more their rotation back into normal. Even in some of the far southern bottoms, with crop insurance, it encouraged people to go on and plant. It was under almost perfect ideal conditions, and they said, let's go for corn.
Yeah, they said, let's go for corn. And you said it didn't have anything to do with price, but given that, generally speaking, the rule of thumb is if you decide to put corn in the ground, extra acres of corn, you probably ought to do something in the marketplace. One, is that the rule to follow today? And two, if they didn't, should they still do something?
Well, there is this feeling at some point in time interest rates will go up because of the economy will get better. And that's A. And B, corn is horribly cheap. That's two. And the third thing is we are going into some of the more volatile price seasons of the year. And I think Chicago isn't trading a higher corn acreage. I bet 90% of the people that talk about the markets don't even have an opinion about it yet. So I think we do have some time. It's not a big percentage, but, our feeling is from some of the key precinct, so to speak, is that it's bigger, and it's something we need to watch through the season.
And how's the rest of the country doing? Do you think that they did as well as Illinois, Iowa, Indiana did in putting a crop in the ground?
The feeling is that it's good, and when I talk to some of my friends in Iowa, the same observation is the presence there, and they were very aggressive on planting corn.
All right. We're going to need to turn our attention to the soybean market. What did you make of the market play today?
Well, it it showed a couple things. We understand that China did buy some beans and bean oil out of Argentina. There is a strong belief that China has basically overbought their nearby position, and they're trying to shift bean demand into the September-October time frame. Their crush margins are getting a little weaker. Some of this is, based on a theory that they have a large surplus of dollars, and if their currency is inflated, it does improve the value of those currencies, that grain, and make an extra profit for them. The other factor is that, it's been my contention that on the planning intentions report, they didn't factor in the 2+ million acres of CRP, and I think that there's some other acreage that will come in. So, I think the soybean acreage is going to be fairly large, and with high-priced corn and soybeans, and particularly soybeans, that should encourage production somewhere in the world. And for example, it did encourage more canola planted in Canada.
All right, so we have a price today on November beans up in the $9 range. Let me see if I get you correctly right. You're willing to wait for corn, but not all that long, is my guess.
Well, my hunch is that we probably should wait till the middle of June before we make any big moves in the marketplace.
For
of course, I'm
beans?
Working from a position of strength. I've basically sold all my old corn above the $4 mark and sold all my old beans at $10 and new crop beans as well. So I really don't have to force the card game, so to speak. I think a person, can wait in here, and there'll be some weather rallies to take advantage of. It is hard for a person, and I have to sympathize, when you're looking at a 100% planted corn crop under the most ideal conditions that we've seen with more modern corn, seed corn, that we have, high plant populations, it sure looks like that as of April 28th, they looked almost like 100% home run right
now. Indeed they do. Thanks so much.
Have a profitable day.
You too. That's Paul Cooley with ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. Happens each and every Wednesday afternoon. If you'd like to hear Paul again, you can do that on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. The shout out to my dad, who will celebrate his 84th birthday on the 19th of May. That's not too far away. Yesterday, he and the boys decided to take the day off because they were done planting corn. They put 36 holes behind them. Not too many 84-year-olds could manage to golf 36 holes, but my father can, and I hope I can when I get that old, too. Thanks, Dad, for all you've done for me. Dave Dickey will be here in a moment. He's got all the ag news for the afternoon.
Agricultural news, USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack says that rural America is in a silent crisis, noting that 90% of the nation's persistently poor counties are rural. Vilsack says the country needs to have a debate about how to invest in rural America, which means reshaping the farm bill, and how government classifies the safety net. Vilsack says, quote, "The safety net has to be more than direct payments, more than counter-cyclical payments, more than loan payments. It also has to include quality jobs in rural America." Meanwhile, Saxby Chambliss, the leading Republican on the House Agriculture Committee, says that the U.S. farm program should be refined but does not need to be radically rewritten to replace crop supports with revenue guarantees or to make rural economic development the centerpiece. Chambliss says he hopes, quote, that we don't talk about going off in an entirely new direction. It is a safety net, and it is working. Senate Agriculture Chairman Blanche Lincoln told reporters that she and Chambliss believe, quote, we have too much on our plate this year to begin farm bill work. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he is willing to bring up climate change legislation ahead of an immigration bill. Reid's comments were intended to help resolve a dispute that emerged last weekend when Senator Lindsey Graham threatened to withhold support for the climate bill if Reid pushed ahead first with an immigration bill. Graham's threat led Senator John Kerry, the lead sponsor of the climate bill, to postpone a Monday news conference to unveil details about the legislation. Kerry said Tuesday he was working with Reid, Graham, and others to revive the measure. Meanwhile, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will begin analyzing the compromised climate change bill. The EPA will examine the economic impact the bill will have from provisions aimed at reducing pollution blamed for global warming. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization today says the global threat from the animal sickness foot and mouth disease has increased after recent outbreaks in Japan and South Korea. The FAO today urged heightened international surveillance. The 2001 foot and mouth disease outbreak caused more than $12 billion of losses to agriculture, livestock, trade, and tourism in the United Kingdom alone, where more than 6 million sheep and cattle were slaughtered in order to prevent further spread of the disease. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Mark Report and of Commodity Week. In the second half hour of our program today on many of these radio stations, we'll talk with Phil Singh of the U.S. Meat Export Federation. Stay with us if you can. If not, you can always hear it online at willag.org. Now up next, once a soybean grower has decided which variety to plant, the next big decision is whether or not to use a seed treatment. I'll have more with Vince Davis. The ultimate goal at planting for the soybean farmer is to put enough seed into the ground to establish a plant population of about 100,000 per acre. The soybean specialist at the University of Illinois says there are many ways to reach that target. Extension's Vince Davis says one way is to consider a seed treatment coupled with a lower seeding rate.
And so for growers who still want to plant more seeds or a higher seeding rate of 170 or 180,000 seeds are probably not likely to find much value in using seed treatments. But for growers who want to reduce their seeding rates, they're more likely to find value of using seed treatments to protect each individual seed or to turn those seeds into productive plants to make sure we're going to have a final stand of 100,000 or greater.
Well, the lower seeding rate in this case can be 140 to 160,000 to the acre. It takes management, especially of weeds, and a proper seed bed preparation. The row spacing, a drill, 15s or 30s, doesn't seem to matter so much, says Davis, as long as the equipment provides for a uniform drop and good seed-to-soil contact. Illinois producers, mostly, he says, do not need to worry about using an inoculant. Inoculants allow the soybean plant to fix nitrogen by promoting bradyrhizobium. Still, the key word there is mostly, especially if the grower intends to use a lower seeding rate.
But where we do have a lot of growers that are including more corn in their rotations and going 3, 4, or 5 years of corn between their soybean cycles, those growers may have more likelihood of finding a benefit for using inoculants. So inoculants are something that they're fairly cheap to use, so they can provide a small level of insurance that you will get proper nodulation and have proper bradyrhizobia. You also don't expect large yield increases from their use in most of our soils in Illinois.
You can read more on soybean seeding rates and plant populations from Vince Davis on the University of Illinois Integrated Pest Management website. The address is www.ipm for integrated pest management ipm.illinois.edu/bulletin. That's ipm.illinois.edu/bulletin. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Wednesday afternoon. The folks at the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana, the Climbers facility there, join us each and every Wednesday. Matt Blaisdell should be on the line with us this afternoon to take a look at the agricultural cash grain markets. Good afternoon to you, Matt. How are you today?
Good afternoon, guys.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's been happening in your area. First, summary of how far along producers are with corn planting, and have they gotten a good start on beans?
Yeah, we're probably 85% of the way done, maybe even a little touch higher than that on the way with corn. Beans are 30% of the way done, and probably would be even a little farther with beans, but the guys got down to corn late last week, and a few of them, or most of them, decided not to wait until after this rain until they started putting beans in the ground, since we are still fairly early.
Are they still happy with that decision, given the rainfall they're looking at over the weekend?
I think they are. You know, it looks like after the rain we had this past weekend and the rain we had this week, and after that, looks like that first 7 to 10 days in May is going to be clear for the guys to get back in the fields.
And have they, in the intermediate time, decided that they would move any grain?
Yeah, we have been fairly busy, both with the rally here and basis is getting improving a little bit here. Still awful lot of guys moving stuff on basis. They're still not pleased with the flat price market, but at least basis is helping them out a little bit on that way.
And that's for new crop then, right?
Yes, that's for new crop.
And how about any old crop?
A few. Really, the guys who decided not to plant beans needed something to do this past week, so we've seen small bits and pieces move here, but nothing large, just little bits and pieces, but nothing at the masses.
Ethanol plant still doing well?
Yeah, margins are weaker than they were the first part of the year, but are still such that, you know, a plant should be grinding here today.
Let's go back to the beans in your area. The processors have been looking for beans from time to time. How are the bids now?
Still quick ship bids. You know, most processors, it's a week to 10 days out, but they're a good 10 to 15 cent inverse spot compared to the balance of May.
And what are your expectations for cash basis corn and beans over the next month?
Yeah, both of them, I'd say, are improving. I'm bullish, probably corn basis just a touch more than beans here, just because most guys do not have May coverage on, but I'm still friendly basis here.
Your bids for the day?
Climbers corn, 357. Delphi beans, 978.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Matt Blaisdell is with the Andersons Climbers facility out of Delphi, Indiana. Joined us here on the Closing Mark Report. On a Wednesday afternoon, we'll return in 2 minutes when we'll talk about the agriculture weather forecast with Drew Lerner.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In business news, Europe's largest oil company, Royal Dutch Shell PLC, today reported a 57% increase in net profit for the first quarter due to higher oil prices and its first substantial production increase in years. Net profit was $5.48 billion, up from $3.49 billion in the same period a year ago. Revenues were $86 billion from $52.2 billion last year. Global Commodities Investment Fund BlackRock Incorporated today says iron ore prices are unlikely to rise much more after tripling in the past year, adding that a recent rally in mining company stocks is not overdone. The price of iron ore used in making steel has jumped to $170 to $190 per ton from a recent low of $60, mainly pushed up by demand from China, the world's biggest steel producer. Traders in China said that iron ore could reach $200 per ton because of strong demand. And Dow Chemical Company today reported strong quarterly results as it benefited from growing demand and price increases. Net income rose to $466 million from $24 million a year ago. The nation's largest chemical maker said the results show that demand is growing in developed markets and strong growth in emerging markets continues to boost the manufacturing sector. On a per-share basis, profit rose to 41 cents per share from 3 cents per share in the same quarter last year. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a Wednesday afternoon. Time to check the agricultural weather forecast. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated joins us from his Kansas City, Missouri office. Drew, thanks for being with us today. Tell me about weather in the Midwest. A little rain over the weekend, maybe a little more rain this coming weekend. Is that right?
But yes, it looks like we've come full circle now. We started off coming into the spring season with a bunch of moisture around. We dried down really well in those first couple of weeks of the planting season. We got some aggressive work done, obviously, and now we're going back into a little bit of a wetter, cooler biased pattern that has us already looking at saturated conditions in quite a bit of the Midwest. We are firming up a little bit here today, and we'll do so again tomorrow. But yes, indeed, we do have another storm system, actually a couple of them, that will be coming on for this weekend and going into next week that will assure us that we are not working the fields quite as aggressively for a while. The soil situation will be saturated for many areas in the heart of the Midwest from the start of the weekend coming up and going through the first half of next week. We have three little disturbances that will be passing through the region, but each one manages to produce a fair amount of rainfall. The first one comes across the area on Friday into Saturday. It kind of puts us into a little bit of a cooler air mass temporarily, but the frontal boundary goes stationary to our south and comes back as a warm front as we go into Saturday night into Sunday. And that ends up creating a second wave of rain. And between those two events, just by themselves, we end up with some pretty impressive rainfall across the part of the region, with totals getting up into the 1 to 3 inch range across especially lower parts of the region, but even into some parts of Illinois, we'll see some pretty hefty amounts of rainfall. Then, of course, we go into next week, and there is another advertised storm system that comes into the heart of the Midwest from the Central Plains. This event is up for debate, I think, at midday today, at least it was. This storm system will come right across the heart of Illinois and into Indiana and Ohio once again, and this all will occur as we go into the middle part of next week. So the bottom line is not a real pretty picture for the heart of the Midwest. Northwestern parts of the region don't seem to get nearly as much rain this time around, but they will have their share of showers that will keep their field work a little sluggish as well.
Does that mean the Delta and maybe Missouri, southern Illinois, parts of southern Indiana are the prime target areas? And what about places further to the north of those areas?
Yeah, I think you're right on here. The greatest rains will be in those southern locations with the way things are setting up at the moment. For Michigan and portions of northern Illinois, northern Indiana, and a fair amount of Ohio, I think we will still see showers and thunderstorms that will come across those areas on Friday into Saturday. The rains will be a lot faster moving through the region. We'll probably end up with a few hundredths of an inch to maybe 5 or 6 tenths of an inch, with a couple of exceptions. And it'll be drying out just about as quickly as it turned wet with this first round of precipitation. But when that front goes stationary and comes back to the north, It will bring more rain across some of those northern areas. So Michigan and northern Indiana and northern Ohio, or most of Ohio, will likely get another half inch to an inch of rain out of that as we finish out the weekend. And then the last system, if it does materialize, will bring us yet another wave of rain with probably a quarter to three-quarter inch rains during the middle part of next week.
Hey, thanks, Drew.
Have a great day.
Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City, Missouri. We'll say so long now to some of our radio stations. For the rest of you, we'll continue with the farming world.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Philip Singh. He's the president and the CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation. Singh oversees the U.S. Meat Export Federation's operations worldwide, provides direction for the strategies and priorities in its international programs, research and technical services, industry relations, and global communications. He also serves as the primary spokesman for the U.S. Meat Export Federation. Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Singh. Please, if you could, tell me about the organization and its history.
Well, first of all, the U.S. Meat Export Federation was founded in 1976. At that time, there were a lot of very progressive producers and people in the industry who recognized that there was a large potential internationally for U.S. red meat products. And so we opened our first office in 1977 in Tokyo. Today we have about 15 offices strategically placed around the world and hoping to take advantage of all the opportunities that we can avail ourselves to. Presently we export about $6 billion worth of meat from the United States, so we're a very, very key exporter of beef, pork, and lamb around the world.
Who are the primary funders of the organization?
Well, the original funder, of course, was just like with many of the other cooperators, like the Soybean Association or the Feed Grain or the Grains Council. We are first funded by the U.S. government. We have about 50% of our budget comes from the U.S. government, and then in addition to that, we have, of course, checkoff dollars, as we all know, that were passed in 1985 in the 85 Farm Bill. And we basically receive funding both from the beef checkoff, the pork checkoff, and then, of course, we receive it from soybean checkoff, both from the USEC, the soybean board, and also we receive it from different states. And the same thing applies as far as corn. So the MEF is an amalgam of a lot of interests coming together because they recognize as you export more product, it creates more opportunity to feed more cattle or feed more pork. And so this is the nature of our organization.
How long have you been the president and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation?
I've been the president of the U.S. Meat Export Federation for 20 years.
That's a long time. I bet you have a lot of good stories to tell. So you've been president for a long time, but you were in Tokyo to begin with. Is that right?
Yes, I lived 10 years in Tokyo. I worked in Japan. I worked six of those years for the U.S. Meat Export Federation. I was there when we had the historic U.S.-Japan beef negotiations back in 1984 and 88, which ultimately led to the full opening of the Japanese beef market in 1991.
And what's happened with that market since then?
Well, I think there's two things that have happened. I think number one is it was a very exciting market when I first went to Japan and 1982, with the representing the U.S. red meat industry, about 96% of all of our pork exports went to Japan, and about 94% of our beef exports went to Japan. So we've diversified, as I said earlier, in many different countries, and so this has helped, I think, strengthen and afford the industry a lot of security as far as vagaries that happen as far as international trade. But on the other hand, the Japanese market's performed very well for us. It's been our leading market for U.S. pork for 17 years. We had unprecedented growth in that market. Last year was a little bit of a hitch, but with the economy and many other factors that came into play, last year, but Japan is our number one value market. We're doing very well in Japan in pork as far as our chilled pork. We're 73% of the total chilled market in Japan, so U.S. pork is readily accepted in Japan. As far as beef, our numbers, our exports of beef this year are up almost 40% from where they were at this time a year ago. We did have a setback with BSE, but frankly, we've worked very strongly and very hard to recover consumer trust. We've basically garnered some market share from the Australians. We've run some pretty extensive consumer campaigns in Japan. We've used a theme called the We Care campaign, which means U.S. producers care about their product, they care about the environment, they care about the consumer. And so this has been very, very successful in the Japanese market. And that's just one of the markets that we work in. But Japan continues to be a very important market to us, both from the beef standpoint and the pork standpoint.
Can we take up BSE just a bit more? That stands for bovine somatotropin encephalitis. Some of our listeners who are not producers, and maybe even some of the producers, won't recognize it. It's mad cow, commonly referred to, but we'll call it BSE today. When BSE hit in the European market, how did the Meat Export Federation swing into action, and what was your process and thought process as you were watching markets close to exports of beef from not this country in particular to begin with, but from other parts of the world?
Well, I think number one is when it hit in Europe, it was in the late 80s, and we really were not exporting very much product to the European Union, and the European Union was a major competitor, and also it was a major producer of beef. At that time, it was the largest producer of beef in the world. So the fact that this basically halted a lot of European beef trade actually served as an impetus for the U.S. and for some other competitive countries to really increase their market share at the expense of the European product internationally. Then, of course, as you all know, we had BSE in Canada in 2003. We had BSE in the United States in December of 2003. And of course, that impacted dramatically worldwide because at that time, the U.S. had grown to be the largest beef exporter in the world. We were larger than Australia. We were also larger than Brazil. And so all of a sudden, the void that was created, much as we benefited from the Europeans' experience, especially Brazil and Australia benefited from our U.S. Experience. And so we've been trying to recover from that setback, and we've done rather well. I mean, we're almost last year, when the markets closed in 2003, we were exporting about $4.5 billion worth of beef. And today, this year will probably be very close to $4 billion. So we're gradually climbing back from that setback.
Can you talk about the politics and the realities of things like BSE and like what's been happening with the pork industry and H1N1?
Well, I think, animal disease and these afflictions are always of major concern to producers and to processors and anybody who's involved in the trade. I think we've seen, the impact of BSE and what that's done as far as dislocating normal trade patterns. And I think it's very important that all countries take a look at international standards. And they're as depicted, for example, in the OIE, the Office of International Epizootics, that's headquartered in Paris. And they've outlined guidelines that you can use and invoke when things come up of this nature. And they have risk classifications. And all of this is based on science, where individual countries will produce information as far as their information. And, of course, this risk classification then will be allotted based on that information. We think it's very important that sound science prevail in a lot of these discussions because, again, whether it was BSE or it was H1N1, you have an emotive reaction by many of these authorities, these health authorities in these countries. All these health authorities are somewhat influenced by the political realities in those countries and by consumers in those countries. And so the politics of these things enters into an area where actually the science should prevail. And we find that is the case with China, was the case with Russia, it was the case with many of our trading partners. And interestingly, the countries that are the most import-dependent, for example, Japan needs to import beef, they need to import pork. They've been more, as we would say, probably scientifically based because they've acknowledged, well, here's the science, here's what the international guidelines say, and they will do this. But in other markets, we've had some more challenges. But in Japan, on beef, they've been very difficult, and that's something that we have to work on, and we have to look at different ways that we can approach the Japanese, given the realities of their politics and where we are in those negotiations as we proceed.
Not to dismiss the health risk to humans of things like BSE and H1N1, but the politics, I suppose, cut both ways. In particular, you already told us, for instance, that when, and I was thinking about BSE in its later segments, but that in the 80s that offered opportunities for the U.S. export market for beef. And this is sort of a day-to-day way of international trade, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very important. But one of the differences we have between now and the 80s when it first surfaced in England is that we know so much more about it. And actually, worldwide, it's very much declining. In all the countries that it's ever surfaced in, it's almost become non-existent. And some scientists would say within 10 years that we won't even have it on this earth. So it's very, very, very much in decline. And so I think that's, you have to take a look at what is the life cycle of this. And, you know, with H1N1, again, on that surface, there was a lot of panic because people didn't quite understand what it was. But then once we understood and understood there was absolutely no worry as far as consumers consuming pork as a result of this, then people begin to understand. But it's always in that very beginning, that's when the scientists really need to speak up, and that's the critical time, because that's when markets close, it's when consumers close their mind, it's when retailers and people pull things off the shelves. So that's the most critical time when there's any kind of concerns, is that those first few days once it surfaces.
Yeah, you suggest that the scientists are saying that BSA may be eradicated across the globe. That wasn't done easily. Not part of and parcel of what you do exactly, but can you explain how that's happening?
Well, I think the scientists, first of all, understand what the cause of it is, and meat and bone meal, and as that's ingested by cattle, that in over a period of time, it's understood how an animal can actually derive and get the BSE. But frankly, all the bovine meat and bone meal now has been banned as far as consumption by beef, and so we're not seeing these agents as being a cause. In the beginning in England, people didn't realize what the actual cause of this was. Now they realize this, and of course countries would export meat and bone meal and use this in feed in other countries, and that's how it spread throughout the world. But now with that known, and with the bans we've had on that, that's why this affliction is going down as dramatically as it is, which is a very good thing.
Yeah, so these are sorts of regulations that are put into the feed supplies
That's right.
And are they regulations in feed supplies in most countries around the world?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, so the U.S. uses the regulations, Canada uses the regulations.
That's right.
Any place that doesn't that you're concerned about?
Well, I think there might be some countries that are not major export countries. But I think as far as all of the major exporting countries that have ever been afflicted with BSE, this is a practice for them. Obviously, they have to do this in order to get back into commerce worldwide. So, any product that you would consume wherever you go around the world, if it's traded a traded product, you know, you're definitely you would not have that as a concern.
This afternoon, we're talking with Philip Tseng. He's the president and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation. You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. More in a moment.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
It's National Blueberry Pie Day. Historians believe that pies can be traced back to the ancient Egyptians. Bakers to the pharaohs incorporated nuts, honey, and fruits in a bread dough, a primitive form of pastry. Drawings of this can be found etched on the tomb walls of Ramses II in the Valley of the Kings. When it comes to pie pastries, credit generally goes to Greece, where pies were made by wrapping a water flour paste around meat. In 1620, the pilgrims brought their favorite pie recipes to the New World. On this day in agricultural history in 1753, Franz Carl Achard was born. A German chemist, Achard invented a process for the large-scale extraction of table sugar from beets. In 1801, he opened the first sugar beet factory in what is today Poland. After further research, he refined his process by using a suggestion from the Institute in France, indicating that fuel costs could be lowered by pressing the beets without cooking. In 1789, the most famous mutiny in history took place on the English ship Bounty against Captain William Bligh. The ship was sailing to Tahiti on an agricultural mission to bring back breadfruit trees. The hope was that the breadfruit plants would grow well in the West Indies and thus become a cheap source of food for slaves. The mutiny came with more than 1,000 breadfruit plants aboard. Those plants never made it to the West Indies. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with the president and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation. His name is Philip Singh. Mr. Singh, let's continue our conversation and talk about developing an export market. Why do we need one for U.S. meat products?
Well, it's very important right now. We export 25% of the pork that's produced in the United States. About $52 of the price of pork that a producer is receiving is coming from the export market. Today we export 10% of the beef that's produced in the United States, and about $135 right now of that beef, that the paycheck that the producer is receiving is derived from the benefit of the export market. I think we have to also take a look at the fact that, and if you look at the U.S. over the last 25 years, per capita consumption actually has been going down both in beef and pork. And the area that's the most exciting has been the international marketplace, where we've seen the growth growing up almost at a 45% degree angle. So you just have tremendous growth internationally, while it's been, at best, sluggish growth, if that, here in the United States. I think we also have to recognize that 95% of the world's consumers live outside the United States. And so it gives the U.S. producer a much more diversified portfolio if you can not only rely on the U.S. market, but also on those growing opportunities you have internationally. I think one other thing is there's many items that people eat internationally that we don't seem to consume anymore here. Beef tongues, for example, pork tongues, livers, and these types of things, they're not readily available anymore. And in some of these markets, like in Japan, in Egypt, in Russia, in China, Taiwan, the variety meats, the offals, are very much prized. And so everything that we sell internationally is sold for more than it's sold in the United States, or else we would sell it here. And that creates upward pressure on prices, which is very good for the producer, the processor, and everybody involved in the meat complex. And also for the people who supply the corn, the soybeans. All this is very important as we look at the whole fabric of this. And so we see with the president wanting to increase exports by in the next 5 years, double exports. Agricultural products from the United States are one of the key components and one of the key growth areas where we really have a comparative advantage.
How much concern does your organization have with the limited number of packers that are in the United States, and with on that note, consolidation of the industry and number of producers that can or have entered the industry of red meat?
Well, I don't really obsess over what the trend in the industry as far as whether it's more consolidation or less consolidation. On the one hand, if you take it from the standpoint of the international buyer, the people who purchase the product, on the one hand, sometimes they do like to be able to purchase from smaller companies that can maybe do things and slow things down a little bit and do things that would be more beneficial or more specific to their interest or their needs, as they always are looking to differentiate their product from their competition in these various markets. But on the other hand, they don't have the marketing ability to have offices and position themselves in a lot of these countries like some of the bigger operators do. So there's a trade-off on all of this, and a lot of these bigger operators can also do things for customers and have different lines for different customers and be specific to these needs. So it's kind of a mixed bag how that works out internationally, but for the most part it's been very successful. And so whether there's multiple players in the United States or four or five great big ones, in our interest, it still works out very well. We have over 120 exporters and processor, purveyor, traders that are packers that are members of our organization. So there's an amalgam of a lot of different interests. And when you consider the Mideast, the Caribbean, Mexico, Asia, Europe, Russia, I mean, there's just a lot for a lot of different people to work on. The big ones, they're involved in all those areas. Some of the smaller ones, they have specialty areas they work on. So to me, it still has worked out, I think, quite positively for us from the international market standpoint, because the buyer can buy from a big operator, but also they can also buy from someone that's a little smaller.
So on that front, you're not as concerned. Are you concerned at all about the capacity or throughput capacity in the United States for packers?
Well, what I'm probably more concerned about, if I look at it from the international standpoint, would be is, you know, barring any more of these international catastrophes or something like this, as I talk to buyers around the world, one of the concerns they have is the supply issue. Will there always be a secure supply? And I hear some countries in some areas where people are talking about maybe conducting longer-term trade agreements where these will be done on a commercial basis, but where they could lock in certain amounts of product, because what we're seeing is meat consumption, pork and beef, is going up dramatically internationally. And as these countries become more well off as far as their economic background and their economies are starting to take off more and more, people are becoming more eclectic as they move from a vegetables and cereals diet to a more protein-based diet. And so one of the concerns that we're starting to see here, especially at the turn of the decade here in 2010, in the last 4 or 5 years, will there always be the supply? And we all know that the United States, Canada, there's a few countries that are positioned to really supply a large amount of product, but will that be the case? And so I think these are more of some of the concerns that we have right now.
Mr. Tsang, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Philip Tsang is the president and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation. He joined us here on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good day.
Support comes from the Westchester Group in Champaign, an agricultural asset management firm specializing in the acquisition, management, and disposition of agricultural investments for institutional, corporate, and individual clients. Information at 800-607-6888 or at westchester-group.com.